the ones that I couldn't get to.
No, that's all good. No, thanks. Cool. Yeah. All right. Hello?
Let me.
Sorry, I love you. You'll be right. You'll be right, Alexis. All right. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for coming along. My name's Kevin Leong. I'm the ACT Fabians convener. I'd just like to thank you all for coming tonight, despite the rain and whatnot. I know it's been quite an ordeal, but glad to see you all here. Before we begin, of course, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Ngunnawal people, and the elders past and present. And I'd also like to just very briefly introduce Professor Frank Bongiorno, who's joining us here tonight. He's I've stolen this from your website, Frank. So
right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, right? But he's an
associate professor. That's what
associate
you promoted me.
Haven't you heard? In our eyes, you're a professor. Don't worry. Associate Professor Bongiorno is an Australian Labor political and cultural historian at the Australian National University. He's got a very impressive academic record, lecturing positions at King's College London, University of New England and Griffith University, and a visiting fellow at Cambridge and University of Texas at Austin. He also writes for Inside Story, which I found personally very exciting. Inside Story being an online place where they put news articles up, mm-hmm. and journalism articles
and
up.
Hard copy too.
Yeah. I think it's now in the Canberra Times.
Canberra Times.
It's a very good publication. I urge you all to read it when you get the chance. Without further ado, I'd like to hand over to Professor Bongiorno, who's going to be talking about blue labour and its rise as a political philosophy in the UK. So if you could all please be in welcoming Professor Frank Bongiorno.
Thanks, Kevin. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here tonight. And I am a Fabian. I was just informed that I'm actually, I think, one of the few speakers you've had who is actually a member of the Australian Fabian Society. So it's a great pleasure to be here. And in fact, the second time that I've spoken to the ACT Fabians, last time I was hosted by Tony Lamb, who's with us tonight, and Jim Jupp, so it's a great pleasure to be talking again. So I've called tonight's talk Blue Labour Lessons for Australia. As I'll suggest later, I'm not sure if there are lessons for Australia. There might be, and perhaps that's something we could talk about in question time. I've handed around also just some pretty rough pictures, so you at least have a sense of what some of these characters look like, and also the transformation that occurs when you are elevated to the House of Lords in Britain, so you can see what you get to wear. Maurice Glasman, the founder of Blue Labour, would perhaps, I think, see some irony in having his ideas discussed at a Fabian Society forum. He's certainly very hostile to the kind of statist tradition that's associated with English Fabianism in its classical era, I guess the late 19th and early 20th century. And Glasman also, he rejects much of the vocabulary of British and North American and Australasian proponents of third way thinking since the 1990s that I guess has been quite common in Fabian societies, both in Australia and in Britain. The very last thing a patient wants to be told by her doctor is that the disease is progressive, he jokes, picking up, of course, on one of the favourite words of Labour parties and Fabian societies, perhaps, in the last few years. British Labour, he claims, has been masquerading as a Liberal Party for too long, and he argues that it should stand in the finest traditions of Richard Tawney and G.D.H. Cole for radicalism and democracy. And you'll notice that the Webbs and H.G. Wells and Bernard Shaw are conspicuously absent from his pantheon of heroes. Now, the aim of what I want to talk about tonight, really, is just to give you a flavour of some of the major ideas of Blue Labour, and also the problems that it experienced over the British summer of 2011, and then finally to explore some of those possible implications for Australia. So firstly, you must be wondering, unless you've gone and done some web searching today, pardon me, who is Maurice Glasman and what's Blue Labour? Well, since he came to national prominence in Britain in 2011, he's been acclaimed as a man of deep compassion and a formidable intellect, or more simply, a breath of fresh air in a Westminster desperately needing it. Yet his ideas have also been vilified as anti-immigrant, sexist and reactionary. Peter Mandelson, defender of the new Labour faith in Britain, condemned Blue Labour language as populist, anti-immigrant, Europhobic and hostile to globalisation. Laurie Penny in The Independent, a newspaper in Britain, saw in its, and I quote, founding principles, a frightening rhetoric of benevolent sexism and xenophobia. Yet following the British Labour Party's failure, the 2010 election, I'd suggest that Blue Labour emerged as the liveliest intellectual strand within, I guess, the post-Blairite and post-Brownite Labour Party. A politics academic at London Metropolitan University, Glasman gained the attention of some powerful figures in the dying Labour government as a community activist campaigning for a London living wage through an organisation called UK Citizens. He wrote a speech that was delivered by Gordon Brown at a large London public meeting during the 2010 election campaign, an occasion that turned out to be one of the very few triumphs for Gordon Brown in a rather sad time for him and the Labour Party in Britain. Now, combining elements of, I guess, German social market thinking and also industrial democracy and also the British cooperative tradition and just a rather old-fashioned English patriotism, I think, Blue Labour subsequently managed to gain the attention of both Miliband brothers, and you've got pictures of those in front of you there, at a time when, along with three other candidates, they were contesting the leadership of the Labour Party in Britain. That the Labour Party leadership in Britain is determined by an electoral college that comprises the rank and file membership of the party, the unions and the parliamentary party, a third each. So it obviously gives the parliamentary party a disproportionate say, of course, a very large say. But they actually run something like a kind of mini presidential campaign to become leader of the Labour Party. And this was going on during the time that Glasman was I guess, increasingly active and increasingly prominent in the media. The Milibands, both of the brothers, and I think they were really the two primary candidates in that, and a handful of other thoughtful members of the parliamentary Labour Party saw Blue Labour as one possible way forward for a party that I think was feeling rather ideologically confused in the aftermath of Blairite modernisation, New Labour and all that went with it. After Ed Miliband won that contest, he elevated Glasman to the peerage, and you have a picture there, and therefore to a seat in the House of Lords. There's British democracy for you. Amid growing media attention, Blue Labour was soon being described in the press as, and I quote, Westminster's most voguish intellectual tendency. Now, when Glasman opens his mouth, many of the kinds of people who attend Fabian events tend to shift uncomfortably in their seats. David Goodart, who was formerly editor of the magazine Prospect, believes that both Blue Labour and also its Conservative Party-supporting alter ego, Red Toryism, signal the end of a liberal ascendancy in British politics. New Labour under Blair tended to embrace globalisation. It celebrated the mobility of capital and labour as a kind of means to freedom and prosperity, whereas Blue Labour tends to be very suspicious of globalisation, suspicious of its tendency, I think, to treat people as if they're commodities. So to the kind of driving rhythms of Blue Labour and almost the worship of the new that was associated with New Labour and Blair, Blue Labour counterposes sort of love of the familiar, the local, resistance of change for change's sake, authenticity, popular culture, tradition. It can sound very conservative. Where New Labour saw in the financial sector an opportunity to generate taxes that it could use for social spending without actually having to redistribute wealth, so it was all very attractive, Blue Labour condemns grasping banks and also a government policy that sort of encourages reckless behaviour by financial institutions. So in Glasman's hands, Blue Labour's guiding principle is that people and nature were not produced to be bought and sold. And so it has a basic humanist thread, I think, running through it. They shouldn't be treated as commodities. And a democratic politics, a left politics, if you like, needs to resist capitalism's tendency to treat them that way. Okay, and hence the hostility to excessive reliance on market forces, to excessive globalisation. And it's interesting, Glasman's been writing along these lines for about 20 years, really, and going back to the 1990s and looking at his earlier work. Very much a consistent theme running through it is this idea that both a state that is too powerful and that a market that is too powerful, each of those poses a threat to communities and to the individual. And so that, again, a left politics needs to temper the authority and the power of both the market and the state. And so he's very influenced by, I guess, ideas that are particularly associated with West Germany after the Second World War, the notion of a social market, okay, this idea of creating a series of institutions that kind of mediate, if you like, between the citizen and the state. Okay, that particular idea is very strong in his thinking. And so a strong emphasis on the role that voluntary organisations like cooperatives, trade unions for that matter, the role that they can play in tempering or modifying the operations of both the market and the state. Okay, so he calls for what he terms a virtue economy, as opposed to a virtual economy, which is what you get with a too powerful banking sector. Now, critics sometimes accuse Glasman of nostalgia, particularly a nostalgia for the older rhythms of British working class life. But what's striking about his earlier writings, he had very little to say about Britain. It was all about West Germany and Poland. His engagement was very much with continental Europe. And I think that's important because, you know, clearly he sees as a model for Britain, he sees as the key model for Britain, the kind of political economy that emerged in West Germany after the Second World War. But as we all know from our 20th century history, that political economy that emerged in the 40s, 50s and 60s was a response to an extremely troubled history, to say the least, a history that Britain, of course, and Australia for that matter, have been very fortunate to have avoided. And so the stress within the German social market on consensus and a middle way and agreement, an agreement between contending groups, and the need to incorporate different groups within a broadly cooperative society was very much a response to the horrors of the mid-20th century in Germany, and the experiences, of course, of the period between the First and Second World Wars. And so I think that's important, that Glasman perhaps places too little stress on the very distinctive and rooted nature of that German response to the problems of forming a post-war social order. Glasman's often very spicy rhetoric against state welfare makes him sound like a right winger. So if he was here and talk, he'd be probably condemning welfare dependence and a state that's too interventionist and all this sort of stuff. You think, oh my God, someone's popped in from the Tory party or something. And it certainly does earn him the ire of the left. But there's also, I think, an equally fierce condemnation of what he calls market utopianism and financial capital. And of course, that tends to align him with the left. And we'd all sit, oh, thank God. But then he'll sort of start talking about the importance of the defence of traditional culture and family and patriotism. And these, and then you'll shift a bit uncomfortably in your seat again. Oh, dear. Faith, family, all this sort of stuff. So he treads this very interesting line, I think, that can sound very radical at times, but also rather conservative. And hence the term blue, of course, which he's taken over from the Tory party, the traditional colour of the Tory party in Britain. So he condemns the tyrannies of the market and the state, and his politics are underpinned by, I think, a vivid, if sometimes questionable, reading of British labour and political history too. In fact, it's an incredibly idiosyncratic reading of the history of British labour and perhaps of modern Western democracies generally. For Glasman, it sort of all went wrong in 1945, which is rather odd when you consider that 1945 was the year that the British Labour Party first came to power in Britain's majority government. So you'd sort of think, oh, well, it's rather an interesting view. But his idea is that the early Labour parties in places like Australia and Britain were very democratic. They were bottom-up organisations. They were organisations based on the grassroots. He sounds a bit like Rodney Cavalier at times when he's making this argument. Some of you will be familiar with Rodney's arguments about the early Labour Party. So it's very much, this idea that the Labour Party of the 1890s and early 20th century was a community organisation. Okay. The problem, he says, with 1945 is that Labour came to abandon that particular self-image and that particular conception of itself. It became a top-down organisation, he says. Yeah, sure, you get the National Health Scheme and you get the welfare state and all that, but it was top-down, it was anti-democratic, it marginalised this sort of older, you know, sort of communitarian tradition within the Labour Party, this democratic tradition. So he's suspicious, if you like, of the kinds of ideas that, you know, in Britain they would associate with the Ackley government of the 1940s, and which, of course, we would associate with the Curtin and Chifley governments of the 1940s. So you can see, it'd be like a, you know, someone who wants to exercise influence in the Australian Labour Party saying, oh my God, it all went wrong with Curtin and Chifley, you know, we're a great party. And so it does have its problems, this sort of rhetoric. But anyway, its view of Blair and Brown is that they weren't a betrayal of Labour tradition. So you might, you know, one of the readings, of course, of the Blairite New Labour and to a lesser extent the Brown government in Britain, is they betrayed that earlier tradition. They betrayed the great traditions of Attlee and Nye Bevan and the National Health Scheme and that status tradition, and perhaps even that they betrayed, you know, the party of Harold Wilson in the 1960s and 70s and became a, you know, a purely middle class party, basically looking out for votes in the south of England. But that's not Glasman's view. For Glasman, Blair and Brown are basically a continuation of the downhill slide of the Labour Party that began in the middle of the century, because, you know, all that emphasis within Blairism on central targets, you know, central government targets, and also the kind of worship, almost worship of the market, and particularly, of course, the City of London, financial capital, the banks, that you get with Blairism, he sees that almost as a continuation of that trend from the mid-20th century of Labour becoming a top-down party that you know, increasingly deals in abstractions rather than in the intimacies and authenticity of working class life, the party from below. So it's a rather idiosyncratic view of Labour history. And he's almost using the past, I think, as a kind of parable. It provides a set of lessons for how the Labour Party needs to reform itself today. Okay, so that's my, you know, sketch, if you like, of Glasman's views. Let me move on to the second part, which is to talk about the problems, the particular problems that all this ran into in the last British summer. So I'm talking here about, in fact, about the time I left Britain after living there for 4 years, so June, July of last year. In fact, I invited Glasman to speak at the university I was at, and it was sort of the moment before the fall now, I could see. You could sort of, as he spoke, it sort of sat there thinking, you know, I reckon this bloke's an accident waiting to happen. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, he was all over the newspapers. Okay, let me tell you about it. Blue Labour hit a number of rocks during the last British summer, and most of them were really the result of Glasman's public activities and profile. After the announcement of his elevation to the peerage in 2010, late, it was basically around Christmas time, Glasman attracted considerable media coverage. Unsurprisingly, journalists were interested in how a chain-smoking, middle-ranking academic living with his wife and four children in a two-bedroom flat above a shop in Stoke Newington, how he'd come to be, and it goes, this is the title, Baron Glasman of Stoke Newington and of Stamford Hill in the London Borough of Hackney. There you have it. He was reputed to have exercised considerable influence over a Miliband, but no one seemed quite sure which Miliband it was. Was it the Miliband who was the favoured to win the leadership election, David, or was it the Miliband who actually won the leadership election, Ed? Or was it both? Well, I think it was both, actually, as it turned out. It was Ed, of course, who appointed Glasman to the House of Lords, but it was David who had most closely aligned himself with UK Citizens, the organisation associated with Glasman, and therefore I think with Glasman himself. It was David, really, who during the leadership campaign had really made the strongest gestures towards the ideas associated with Glasman. I mean, David Miliband had committed his leadership bid to training community organisers, for example, to revitalising the Labour Party grassroots and so on. And it was also David for whom Glasman wrote a key speech during the leadership campaign as well. So the alignment at that stage seemed to be with David Miliband and not Ed. So the one of the interpretations of the raising to the peerage, to the House of Lords, was that it was a conciliatory gesture, perhaps, by Ed Miliband to his brother David and to David's supporters. A piece of a magnanimous gesture in victory. Yet Glasman was soon being spoken about by fascinated journalists as Ed's guru. They love that term. And Ed did nothing to dispel that impression, nor did Glasman himself, who seemed to be relishing this unexpected limelight. Now, there was more to Blue Labour than Glasman, and there was a series of academic-type seminars, really, in London and Oxford late in 2010 and early 2011 that brought Glasman together with a number of academics and a handful of politicians, the most significant of whom was John Cruddas, who's the Labour member for Dagenham and Raynham. David Miliband actually attended those, and so eventually did some of Ed Miliband's staffers. Basically, the content of these seminars was to work through a number of issues, I guess, that seemed very pressing in the light of Labour's failure at the May 2010 election. And there's a resulting e-book, so you can go onto the web if you're interested in this sort of stuff. It's called The Labour Tradition and the Politics of Paradox, and it lays out, I guess, it came to be seen as a kind of manifesto of Blue Labour. So if you wanted a sort of basic statement of what this movement supposedly stands for, that's probably the best place to go. And that in itself caused problems, because many of those who contributed to it, to the seminars and to this e-book, didn't really see themselves as producing a manifesto. So there was a kind of confusion of purpose here that I think began to open up tensions between some of the individuals who were involved in these activities. But the really serious rift came in July 2011 when Glasman gave an interview for a Fabian publication, suggesting that immigration to Britain ought to be stopped. These comments, of course, featured prominently in the right-wing press. Glasman had already, just a few months before, controversially accused the previous Labour government of lying to voters about immigration and had called, of all things, for a dialogue with those sympathising with the racist English Defence League. So it'd be a bit like, Kim Beazley back in 1998 saying, we really need to get much closer to One Nation or whatever. The July statements, however, about immigration turned out to be the last straw, and several of Glasman's allies dissociated themselves from him and from the Blue Labour project. And the disaffected included John Cruddas, for example, whose seat's in East London, so where right-wing organisation and anti-immigrant agitation is a real problem for the Labour Party and for the communities, the immigrant communities who are affected by it. So this mishap, if that's the word for it, arose from two prominent features of Blue Labour. The first, I think, is its increasing identification with Glasman himself. And remember, a Glasman who is now, on whom feature articles are appearing in the newspapers and this sort of thing. So, a Glasman who's becoming almost a kind of a minor media celebrity. So that's one point. And the other, which I think is probably more important in some ways, is Glasman's English nationalism. And I want to talk about that in a moment. So firstly, Glasman was in most respects a political novice. My description of his elevation to Lords says it all. He's an academic one minute, and then all of a sudden, he's someone with a platform in the upper house of the Westminster Parliament. It was Glasman's unpolitician-like qualities that helped attract so much media attention in the first place. He neither looked, as you've seen there, neither looked nor sounded like a resident of the Westminster Village. Yet what had initially seemed to be a virtue was soon exposed as a weakness. Glasman was a remarkably frank speaker, including with journalists. As I heard him speak at the event we did, I thought, thank God there's no journalists here. Anyway, sometimes there are journalists there. By the summer of 2011, Blue Labour and Glasman were an accident waiting to happen. Second, I think more importantly in some ways, the privileging of the national over the international, the familiar over the strange, the parochial over the cosmopolitan, all of this, I think, combined to create a kind of blind spot. Now, I think there was arguably validity in Glasman's claim that the Labour Party in government had paid too little attention to many traditional working class voters' concerns about things like employment and housing and the ways in which immigration to many towns was affecting their people's opportunities for employment and for housing. So there was a resentment building up in the latter years of the Labor government that Labor didn't deal terribly effectively with. And there was surely some justification for Glasman's view that Gillian Duffy, now who remembers Gillian Duffy? She probably wasn't a household name here. Well, Gillian Duffy was the woman who Gordon Brown dismissed as a bigoted woman. Do you remember that when he left his microphone? Now, Mrs. Duffy, you know, was a very traditional Labor supporter from Rochdale, you know, in fact, the great sort of home of the cooperative movement in Britain, really. She expressed some pretty mild concerns about immigration, I think. Pretty mild. It wasn't racist. There were pretty mild concerns about immigration. And anyway, Brown might have misheard her, I think, and gets in his car and starts berating one of his aides about, you know, what had just happened, you know, in front of the TV cameras, still has his, I think it was Sky News microphone on, and referred to her as, oh, she was just a bigoted woman. Yeah. And of course, out it went, and it was not Gordon's greatest moment. But this became, I think, for Glasman and for others, emblematic of the way in which the Labor Party had become remote from, you know, key supporters, from people who had traditionally been the staunchest of Labor Party supporters, and Duffy was certainly one of those. That said, I think anyone listening to Glasman, not just in that interview, but on other occasions too, might well have imagined that mutuality stopped at Dover. Now, that wasn't Glasman's attitude, but he'd done little in the interview or on other occasions to qualify his harsh criticisms of immigration policy. Unlike the Blairites, now I'm sure, you know, many of you here, like me, not great admirers of Tony Blair, would that be a fair comment, on various grounds? Yeah, well, I belong to that club. But it does have to be said that under Blair, you know, Britain was certainly very conscious of its international responsibilities. There was a strong emphasis on aid, on development. Now, unfortunately, one of the directions in which this consciousness of international responsibilities went was preemptive strikes and so on, and war on Iraq. But it is certainly true that one could not accuse New Labour and Blairism of parochialism. I mean, clearly there was a, if you like, a cosmopolitanism, an internationalism about New Labour. And you know, I think that, you know, that was certainly something that Glasman objected to, really, that you know, this almost a kind of privileging of internationalism over the local and the familiar. Now, I've heard Glasman speak in defence of democratic trade unionism in China, but the reality is that this wasn't one of his priorities, and I think there was a real privileging of a kind of English nationalism over a sense of Britain's wider responsibilities in the world. And I say English nationalism advisedly because poor old Scotland and Wales don't seem to come into this much either. And as for Northern Ireland, of course, it's not there at all. But, you know, it's striking that it is very much an English nationalism that he seems to be advocating, and there's very little sense of Britishness, of the British Isles, in it. And when you consider that, you know, how important Scotland in particular is to the British Labour Party's electoral fortunes, it's an extraordinary sort of omission. Yet despite many predictions over the summer, neither Glasman nor Blue Labour went away. Now why? How on earth did it survive? Well, firstly, Glasman apologised profusely for shooting his mouth off. Secondly, and this is, I think, the most important reason, Ed Miliband didn't abandon him or his ideas. On the contrary, the Labour leader's speech at the party's annual conference in September 2011, this is only, what, three, four months after all this stuff, it continued Ed Miliband's identification with key new Labour ideas. He acknowledged the flaws in Labour's immigration policy, he condemned predatory behaviour by banks, he extolled productive industry and vocational training, which is one of Glasman's preoccupations. He criticised the commodification of human beings. He advocated employees being put on boards that would determine executives' pay, executive salary, all the kinds of ideas that Glasman had been running with. Now, Miliband's speech, I think, underlines something that was missed by many commentators. I missed it too, I must say. I wrote on this for Inside Story in August, I think, 2011, just after I came back to Canberra. What many of us missed at the time, when you know, we probably thought it was the end of Glasman and Blue Labor, is that the party leadership, I think, needs Blue Labor, and it probably needs Glasman. At a time when the Conservative-led coalition government's cuts are you know, clearly tearing at the fabric of British society, and also I think when Labor has largely endorsed the need for very substantial cuts, so Labor to some extent has gone along with those cuts in Britain, the opposition, Labor under Miliband, Ed Miliband, needs a way of distinguishing itself. It needs some sort of distinguishing philosophy, and I think that the ideas of Blue Labor have provided, not all of that, but certainly Blue Labor have provided much of that. Labor under Ed Miliband isn't going to have the option of doing what the Blair government did, particularly in its second and third terms, and that was essentially using the tax receipts, the tax proceeds generated by the activities of a bloated banking sector for social spending. I can remember one of our Fabian colleagues, actually, Race Matthews, talking at Old Parliament House at a conference in about 2003 and, you know, really complimenting, quite rightly, the kinds of social programs that were being pursued by New Labour during its second term with Brown as Chancellor of the Exchequer. But we can see now in retrospect that this was largely being funded by the tax proceeds being generated by the banking sector, and of course we know that particular way of doing social democracy is dead. It's dead in Britain at any rate, and Labor needs to find a new way of doing things. And I think that the ideas, you know, all these notions of community organising and bottom-up, I guess organisation of Labor at the local level and social, you know, he doesn't use the term social capital, but I guess it's very much the kind of idea of social capital. All that, I think, is music to the ears of a party that needs some sort of sense of direction in a pretty difficult set of circumstances. And it's striking, too, that the most recent manifestation of New Labour thinking, which is called the Purple Book, so this is a kind of collection of essays that essentially attempts to revive or to renew the New Labour project. What I was struck by when I read the Purple Book was the similarity to many of the ideas being pursued by Glasman and Blue Labour. Again, a hostility to the idea of a traditional welfare state, to a top-down politics, and advocacy, very much a strong emphasis on community organising and on the empowerment of individuals at the local level. Okay, so what's happening here is a really large area of common ground amongst different groups that, you know, might otherwise be seen as contending. So in other words, you know, the kind of neo-Blairites, I suppose you might call them, and those who are closer to the ideas associated with Glasman and Blue Labour. So I think what's happened is the Blue Labour as a political brand is probably pretty much dead, but many of the ideas that are associated with it certainly are likely to animate the British Labour Party for many years ahead. Let me just very briefly, in the last part of the paper, talk about possible implications of all this for Australia. Now, I mean, I think most of you here would be aware there's been considerable mutual borrowing, hasn't there, between the British and Australian Labor parties and Labor movements. I mean, it is very well known, for example, that Tony Blair, the whole Third Way idea, was heavily indebted to the Hawke and Keating governments and to, you know, that combination of, I guess, neoliberal policies and social democracy that was very much a characteristic of the 80s and 90s Labor experiments at the federal and state level in Australia. Now, you know, the left is clearly experiencing a sense of crisis internationally at the moment, so it seems reasonable to think in transnational terms about solutions. That said, I think there are also grounds for scepticism about any sort of easy translation of Blue Labor to Australia. Blue Labor is in many respects a specifically British or even English answer to British problems. It's the product, of course, of the decline and fall of a long-serving Labor government. And it's also a response to efforts by the Tories to Philip Blond and Red Toryism, which is a kind of set of ideas not unlike Glasman's, except coming from the Tory side. And also to David Cameron, all that stuff about, the big society, you know, those ideas that are, again, very much about promoting the local and the voluntary and so on. I think Blue Labour was a response to the efforts by the Conservatives to appropriate that kind of communitarian tradition for the Tory party. So it comes very much out of a specific moment in British politics and a set of, very specific British problems. I think Blue Labour was also part of an effort, as I've already suggested, to redefine Labour's philosophy in the wake of the global financial crisis. And its effects, of course, in Britain have been much more dramatic than they have been here in Australia. And the Labour Party, being the governing party at the time, was quite rightly considered complicit in the failure of the banking system and all the problems that gave rise to in 2008 and 2009, and indeed ever since, really. There are other reasons for caution too. I think the Australian political class, of which I guess many of us here would kind of be members, seems considerably less disillusioned than its British counterpart with fairly centralised state authority. And also, I think, less enthusiastic about the capacity for renewal at the local level. I think the whole rhetoric of localism is weaker in Australia. And, you know, you don't get much rhetoric in Australia amongst people on the left about, you know, the dangers of excessive welfare dependence. I mean, it's there. We know, you know, some of our colleagues in the Labor Party and so on who say such things. But the rhetoric is nowhere near as strong as I think you get within, really mainstream British Labor Party thinking today. So I think that difference is important. And, of course, there are historical reasons for this. I mean, Australia, I think going right back to the 19th century, has had a much more practical, utilitarian, pragmatic, really, attitude to state intervention. Australians, you know, through their history and their recent experience, I think have much more faith in the ability of government and the state to actually affect pretty good outcomes. And whereas I think there's much more scepticism about that on the British left, and that goes back to, I think, a stronger tradition of localism and a stronger cooperative tradition. And I think just a much greater scepticism about the state on the British left, going right back to the radical traditions of the 18th and 19th centuries, whereas I think in Australia we've always had a much stronger statist tradition that perhaps goes back to our convict heritage. It certainly goes back a long way. Other Blue Labour ideas might have stronger applications. I mean, there's clearly been a movement among sections of the left for kind of attempt to reclaim patriotism for the Labour Party. Think of some of David McKnight's ideas or Tim Sue Parmesan, that book Reclaiming Patriotism by a young author. I think that does have elements, or at least has some points in common with Glasman's attempt to ensure that the Labour Party isn't locked out of claims to English patriotism. Glasman also places strong emphasis on faith communities or churches, if you like, mosques and so on. And, there's perhaps an element of that too within sections of the Labor Party. I guess in Australia, much of the discussion, we're talking about this actually just before we started tonight, I mean, much of the discussion about religion and politics in recent years has been about the links between certain Christian churches and the right. But I'm very struck by the way in which, a kind of social justice agenda in Australia has been a way in which many Catholics have reconnected with the Labor Party. I mean, Tony Lamb, will know this better than anyone here, perhaps, of the ways in which many Catholics were alienated from the Labor Party as a result of the split in the 1950s, particularly in Victoria. But I think what happened is that later generations of Catholics reconnected with the Labor Party through a social justice agenda. And I think that's also very much a part of Glasman's vision, this idea that, people who are motivated often by religious impulses, have a strong quest for social justice and can find a kind of common ground on which they can cooperate within their local communities. He's very big on this, and it's one of the most attractive features of all this. It's, I think, one of the reasons why, you know, his anti-immigrant comments need to be placed in perspective. This is someone who's clearly worked very closely with various local ethnic communities within Britain. Blue Labour's stress on community organising, community organising and grassroots revival is certainly echoed in the Brax, Faulkner and Carr review, the 2010 review of the ALP. But of course, that review, I think, languishes in some ways. I mean, some parts of it are being implemented, other parts of it are being ignored. I think there's a significant difference, frankly, between the British situation and here. Ed Miliband, the leader of the British Labour Party, is clearly committed to many of the ideas associated with community organising. I get little sense that Julia Gillard has much sympathy with them. I mean, she's talking about party renewal, but it's pretty small beer, I think, coming out of the 2011 National Conference, for example, and you didn't get much sense of a really strong commitment to that at all, really. To finish up, I mean, it seems to me that the Glasman show does have some fainter echoes of Australia's Latham interlude. Like Glasman, Mark Latham celebrated the value and authenticity of popular culture and traditional values of the working class. He professed a robust nationalism designed to appeal to ordinary Australians. He went out of his way to unsettle the pieties of sort of left-leaning, Labour-voting intellectual types. Think of his views on refugees, on social responsibility, on mutual obligation. And, of course, he did all that while, rather like Glasman, really being an intellectual himself. So there was a kind of sleight of hand involved. But I think that, I mean, I was often reminded of the Latham interlude when I heard Glasman speak, and particularly when it all went pear-shaped in mid-2011, of which many of us would have vivid memories in the Australian case of a few years ago. Blue Labour, I don't think, has generated a large number of original public policy ideas, but certainly grappling with many of the big questions about, you know, how a party of the left needs to respond creatively to sort of post-GFC environment. Again, the lessons for Labour in Australia are unclear here. I mean, Australia's more affluent than Britain, I think. It certainly has lower unemployment. I think it has stronger social cohesion, and that, I think, perhaps undercuts a sense that the kinds of ideas about community building that Glasman talks about, you know, have a relevance here. But yet, think of Glasman's critique of the banks, the idea that you know, the excessive dependence on an overgrown banking sector is a problem for Britain and has damaged the British economy and has damaged British society. We do have an Australian parallel, surely, don't we now? I think, mining. The kind of critique that someone like Paul Cleary, for example, some of you might have read Paul Cleary's very interesting book on the mining sector. And I think there is an emerging critique, isn't there, about the problems that an overdeveloped mining sector is posing to the economy, to other sections of the economy, you hear about two-speed or multi-speed economies. Also think about the fly-in, fly-out phenomenon, which clearly isn't about regional development or community building. It's not hard to imagine how someone like Glasman would respond to that. The undermining of the environment, but also the dividing of Aboriginal communities over, you know, how to respond to mining companies. All of those sorts of things, I think, in some ways parallel the kinds of issues to which Glasman has drawn attention in relation to the banking sector in Britain. And just generally, I think, the mining sector's clout, its political clout, its capacity to fight off taxes, pesky taxes, and its capacity to, I don't know, perhaps even bring down a prime minister, who knows. I think that clearly does suggest a kind of parallel. Finally, Blue Labour's critique of both markets and the state might offer a way in which we can think about our own past, and particularly the recent past of the left. I mean, it seems to me that the era, the period now, that the left in Australia is most preoccupied with, it's no longer the legendary 1890s or the 1940s or the Whitlam period. The period now that figures so prominently in public debate and public discourse is the 1980s. So much of the debate that we're dealing with on the left in Australia today is about the meaning, the essential meaning of the 1980s. Now, I would argue that a lot of the celebration of 1980s reformism, particularly those economic reforms, while justified in many respects, is surely a celebration of top-down reform, isn't it? Isn't it a celebration of the superior wisdom of politicians and bureaucrats who are able to do things like float the dollar and wind down tariffs and all the rest of it, often in the face of popular ignorance and resistance? I think it's also very much it's a celebration, I think, of the superior wisdom of the political class. It has very little to say about political institutions, about democracy. And I think that one could make an argument that for all the economic success that was generated by the reforms of the 1980s and 90s, it left a kind of hole in political culture, in political debate. The terms of political debate narrowed. It arguably impoverished, impoverished political debate in this country. And it certainly had very little to say about how communities could organise themselves and build cohesion. So it was very much a top-down process. And I think that in some ways the Glasman critique, whilst, as I said earlier, I think it's very exaggerated and rather idiosyncratic, I think the Glasman critique of a top-down politics might offer some clues about the ways in which we can respond perhaps a bit more imaginatively to those reforms of the 80s and 90s and think about where social democracy in Australia needs to take reform for the next generation, because I rather fear that, like clapped out generals, we're still perhaps fighting the battles of yesteryear rather than thinking about where we need to go next. So that's all. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Frank, for a very rich presentation. There's a lot to take in there. Not really sure where to start, so I might just throw it out to the audience, really. Unfortunately, this mic doesn't stretch out very far, so if you could just please half shout, if we can hear you, if that's okay. And is there any questions? Anyone wants to begin?
Maybe a comment more than anything else, Frank. To me, one of the most interesting things as far as the relevance of blue labour to us here in Australia is the problem we have as a party, referring to the Labor Party, has become disconnected to much of its grassroots communities in some parts of Australia. We now see polling figures and election results even that have only been previously achieved by Wayne Berry here in the ACT in the 1998 election. And that actually means that we have to start sometime soon, preferably quite some time ago, thinking about, how do we make sure that we engage and re-engage with those communities. And there's clearly a lot of things that Glassman's done wrong, but at the same time, he's actually been pioneering ways of thinking about how do we actually reconnect with people that Labor over there has actually lost. How do you find ways to actually tap into that in the community and ultimately have that reconnection be the source of developing new policies and new ideas about how you proceed from there? That's something that we need to be thinking about here before it gets worse for us.
Yeah, maybe to tack onto that, I think that's absolutely right, because otherwise we face policies such as the Western Sydney test, perhaps, or the turning back the boats test, and whatnot.
Yeah.
Is there anything in Blue Labour's tradition that should be picked out?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I think the emphasis on community organising is something. Well, it was picked up, frankly, in the 2010 review quite explicitly. They refer to Ed Miliband and community organising, so I think there's a kind of recognition there. I mean, I suppose the point I was making at the end is I think that a lot, that problem of if you like, the disconnection that has occurred that you talk about, I think, isn't merely a product of recent times or developments. I think it goes back to much to a much longer-term set of trends, which I referred to at the end as that impoverishment of political debate that occurred in the 80s and 90s. That's where I differ, I think, from someone like Rodney Cavalier. I mean, I greatly admire Rodney's the work he does, and I have some sympathy for his critique about the death of the party below that he talks about. But I think that the death of the party below is partly a product of massive transformations that have occurred in the terms of political debate in Australia since the 1980s. And, you know, as I said, if you like, arguments about a much narrower range of issues. And it's made political mobilisation much, much more difficult, including at the local level. But I agree entirely with what you're saying, and clearly there are, you know, some lessons from the British case. It's still a much more successful party on the ground in Britain. You know, it's got, I think, five times as many members as the Australian Labor Party, and Britain isn't five times as big as Australia. So,
I was interested in Glassman's study of Europe and just what it was he studied about Germany. Germany is interesting in that it had developed quite a different style of capitalism after World War II. I mean, you've got these workers' councils, which at least until the last few years, where I think they've been overtaken by the Anglo-Saxon model of capitalism, workers' councils actually had quite a bit of power in relation to boards. And also, there's a lot more respect for within the culture of business firms was much more to keep people in employment, which meant you had quite a different style of innovation developed in Europe than you had in the Anglo-Saxon world, particularly in America, where you know, you hire and fire pretty rapidly. You tend to get the sort of big bang innovation, whereas in Germany, because people were quite secure in their jobs, you know, it was workmanship and quality that really counted. So German engineering has always been very, very respected. I wondered if he studied those sorts of things.
Exactly.
I must say I think we don't pay enough attention to the different styles of capitalism, and there are several different styles around, historically, that we've seen, about five or six at least,
would be characterised. Sure, no, exactly. That's exactly what he studied. I mean, he did a doctoral thesis essentially on that issue, and it's clear that a lot of his ideas are an attempt to apply that kind of model to Britain, although he dresses it up, of course, within the language of the British cooperative tradition and the British mutual tradition. It's, you know, it's all about coal and you know, GDH coal, I mean, and Tawny and so on, but I think the core of his ideas do come from the German social market and the very and also the related ideas about German co-determination, so workers' councils and industrial democracy and worker participation and so on. So he's very big on that, although he doesn't harp on about his indebtedness to Germany, you know, in his political rhetoric. The actual packaging of it, if you like, is within a kind of English patriotic language. Yeah, but you're right. I mean, that's where it's coming from. Yeah.
To what extent do you think Glassman has been vindicated by the revelations that have been made in the last 18 months or so about what New Labour did in power with immigration? Essentially, people from the party have now come out and said, look, we opened the floodgates and we wanted to piss off the Tories and we wanted to use immigration as a form of social engineering. And all of this sort of stuff's now coming out in the open. The embarrassment to some extent of the party. I mean, what does it really say about the party if somebody is relatively mild-mannered as Glassman is seen as some kind of wild man? I mean, they certainly seem to be completely out of touch with reality, surely. I mean, immigration is a huge issue in England, as it is all across Western and Northern Europe.
Pardon me, it is. I mean, there was a kind of... there was a sleight of hand in Glassman's comments about immigration, because as we know, Britain is a part of the EU, and a very large amount of immigration into Britain is essentially immigration from the European community. And so the idea that this can somehow be frozen, which is what he was calling for, is an absurdity. It can't. I mean, that's a gate that basically was opened many, many years ago now, and there's no going back on that. I mean, part of Glassman's problem... I mean, there are two... I think he has two sets of concerns about migration. One is about the ways in which the handling of migration in recent years sort of epitomises this notion of human beings being treated as commodities. So in the British case, of course, it was, you know, people being brought in to you know, fill the labour market, and often, you know, lower paid jobs that, that local workers weren't prepared to perform. Okay, and he found this objectionable because it epitomised that notion of individuals as commodities rather than human beings. His other concern, I think, was about communities. It was about the ways in which community building was problematic in a context where people, you know, where there's high levels of labour mobility, I suppose is the best way of putting it. And so I think that was another preoccupation, this emphasis that he has upon, you know, the importance of community cohesion was offended by high levels of migration. I mean, I haven't followed the migration issue in Britain in great detail. I think it's broadly true that it was clearly an issue for the British Labour Party at the last election. I don't think it lost them the election. I think that idea is about, I believe it's a complete myth. But, you know, clearly that in many communities there was a significant level of concern among many traditional Labour voters about migration, and it's clear that you know, Glasman's ideas have gestured towards that concern. I think he uses migration also symbolically. He sees it as, if you like, symbolic of the ways in which the Labour Party has become increasingly remote from a group of people who he believes it's there to represent, workers. Working class communities. So it also, immigration works as a kind of a symbolic issue for him too, I think.
Okay, well, if there are no other questions, well, just thanks very much, Associate Professor Frank Mangione, for coming along, and much food for thought, and if you could all just join me in thanking Professor Frank. Thanks everyone very much for coming. Just a very quick plug for future Fabian Singers. If you're not a member, please join, because this is all just run out of volunteer time, and we lose passion, faith, and we also start to doubt ourselves, and no one joins. Our member numbers are particularly bad, even by ALP standards. So please, you can join on the website, and we'll be looking towards holding an AGM in June, so look out for that as well. So thanks very much for coming.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks very much. No.